Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn. Fancy digs today. We are in the Catholic Answers studio. I get to sit in a comfy chair. I got a nice boom mic here, and I have fellow apologist Mr. Joe Heschmeyer. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. It feels a lot like being at work.
Right. This is where we are. Yes. Now, I'm a little bit jealous of you because you I'm visiting the Catholic Answers studio only for like 2 days.
Right.
But you get to be out here for a month, getting a month break from Midwest weather to be here in California. So I'm a little jealous.
I very conveniently scheduled video stuff during the coldest part of the Midwestern year. And then it has been in the 60s, 70s, or low 80s every single day since we've been here with not a cloud in the sky. It's unbelievable.
And I say, good for you, my friend.
You know, Oscar Wilde said that the shame of youth is that it is wasted on the young. And it's tempting to feel the same way about California.
Right, that the weather's wasted here. Other people would use it better. What I wanted to talk today is, well, actually, it was funny. I told Joe, hey, I'm going to be in the studio tomorrow. Let's talk. And I just want to talk about whatever you're just jazzed about, something you're just really excited to talk about. And I just got an advanced copy of your new book. Well, it's out now. Mm-hmm. And the book has a wonderful self-explanatory title, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. So it's a mystery. What could this book possibly be about?
What could the thesis of the book be?
So I love it that we have something, because a lot of people, including many Protestants, are more interested in learning about Christian history. Mm-hmm. And I think many people find their way into the Catholic Church. This happened for me, that I looked at all the Christian denominations and thought, all right, well, what did the first Christians believe? Mm-hmm. What did they believe? I would like to be close to what they believe. And so there are many more Protestants who are interested in that. It leads them to Catholicism. And I think there are Protestant apologists who step forward and say, oh, wait, not so fast. The early church is not the Catholic Church mm-hmm. we might think of. And one of the arguments that they raise, it relates to the papacy. They might say, okay, you'll find some similarities here, but when you think Catholic, what's the first thing that pops into your mind? The Pope.
Right.
Right? Catholic, Pope. But then they'll say, look, when you go back into the early church, you go back to the first century, they'll say, well, there wasn't a pope. We don't see anyone talking about a first century bishop of Rome. So, and this is a thesis that is common, not just among some Protestant apologists, but even among some Catholic scholars.
Yeah, Father Eno, you got Eamon Duffy, who's a very well-respected medieval Catholic scholar. Mm-hmm. There are J.P. Meyer, Raymond Brown, plenty of Catholic mm-hmm. scholars who claim that there was not just not a pope in the first and second century, or first and, you know, up to the
early
mid-second
century, yeah.
But that there wasn't even a bishop of Rome at all. Not even a debate about what was his authority, what was his jurisdiction, but just he didn't exist, is their claim, which is a really radical claim.
Right, so that there was just a council of priests who was overseeing the church at Rome, and then the office of bishop emerged slowly after that, with the office of the papacy mm-hmm. merging even further after that, which would make one doubt whether the papacy is even a part of the deposit of faith at all. So that is what I want to talk about today, this idea that in academic-y terms, we would say the debate over the mono-episcopacy.
Yep.
Was the early church, and I think many Protestants have tried to argue for this, that it's just a confederacy of believers, mm-hmm. little house churches. Was there in every region or every city where there's a church, was there a single bishop presiding over the church in that region, number one? And then number two, was that the case for the church in Rome? Because as Catholics, it's not just any bishop that's most important, it's the bishop of Rome. Mm-hmm. Like, was there one in the first century? And I think my view would be very similar to yours. This is a issue that I've addressed before on the channel. It was actually something that I addressed in one of my previous videos. If you look online, I have a rebuttal to the strongest argument against Catholicism mm-hmm. offered by a Protestant author, Jerry Walls.
Yes.
And he went on Cameron Bertuzzi's podcast and he talked about this very issue. And so I went through that, offered a lot of insights. But you've done even more research on this than I have. So you're jazzed to talk about this. I'm jazzed to talk to you.
I mentioned Jerry Walls in this chapter. Like it's very much like in the common discourse right now among Protestants and among Catholics alike.
Mm-hmm. So what would be your basic thesis? Let's get people to understand that you'll have some Protestants, even some Catholic scholars saying, well, there wasn't really a single bishop of Rome. that emerged in a very delayed way that kind of accrued over time. And you're saying, no, that the office of the episcopate, the bishop, mm-hmm. is something we can trace back to the New Testament, mm-hmm. and it's something we can find continuity from the New Testament through the first century and the early second century.
Yeah, the positive case would look something like this, that the threefold structure, that there's one bishop accompanied by priests or presbyters and deacons, is something that goes back to the time of the apostles, goes back to the apostles, goes back ultimately then to Christ, and that it was something that was viewed as an inheritance from Judaism, that Judaism has this three-tiered structure of high priest, and Levite, and that very, very early on, we see these connections being made implicitly but pretty obviously in First Clement's letter in 96 AD, more explicitly in the early 200s in one of the ordination rites for a bishop in which he's compared to the high priest. Those kind of connections are on people's minds, and that this was something that was understood, as St. Ignatius of Antioch says, if you don't have this three-tiered structure, you don't have the Catholic Church. You don't have a church.
And I think that this is huge. Like for me, I did another video a while back called The Church Father That Protestants Fear the Most. Mm-hmm. And I asked you, I said, Joe, take a guess. You said, oh, St. Ignatius of Antioch.
Yes.
Because he's very, very early. We can date mm-hmm. him to early second century, like 110, 107.
Yep.
So we're talking now within one to two generations of the crucifixion, within a generation of the apostles themselves. And what he discusses, that he's very clear that the authority structure within the church, it's not the Bible. No, right. No discussion about any kind of a fixed or closed canon mm-hmm. of scripture that serves as the authority. Rather, he says things like, follow the bishop as Jesus follows the Father.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you're right. I think it's literally
do nothing without the bishop, which is
bishop.
Very strong kind of Episcopal language.
I want to say it's Magnesians, literally mm-hmm. the Magnesians, where he says that if you do not have bishop, priest, and deacon, you don't have a church.
Exactly.
That's not the Catholic, and he uses the phrase, the Catholic uh-huh. church. Now, to pardon going back what you said about the New Testament, though, mm-hmm. how would you look at the idea that, and this is something the view that, I've always held, is that it seems in the New Testament that the offices of bishop, priest, and deacon can seem somewhat interchangeable mm-hmm. in how the terms are applied. Like Paul refers to himself with the title as a deacon.
Yes.
Peter refers to himself as a fellow priest. That mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. bishop, Greek, episkopoi, overseer. Mm-hmm. The English word priest, that if you're reading in the New Testament letters, it's where the title elder might be found, mm-hmm. is the Greek word presbyteroi, the presbyteroi. Right. And then the diakonoi is where we get the word deacon.
Right.
So deacon, priest, bishop, or diakonoi, presbyteroi, episkopoi. It seems like in the time of the New Testament, these are at least much more interchangeable than by the time of Ignatius.
Yeah, that's certainly true, partly because terminologically, they're kind of being set still. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, you know, there was an incident when President Biden was vice president, he presided at a gay marriage. And in English, saying the vice president presided, we have no trouble with that.
Right.
But someone reading that in translation is going to be very confused. Like, well, how could the vice president be the one presiding?
Because if you read it literally, it would be the vice presider was the main presider.
Exactly.
They would trip over themselves.
And,
so you're saying this is...
With this in Greek, you have overseer, elder, servant. Those are what bishop, priest, deacon, or bishop, presbyter, deacon mean. And so people are confused by that because the Greek sometimes is being used in an official, technical, more specific context, but more often is used in a much looser context. Mm-hmm. To give you an example, if you look at the, do a word study on diakonoi, you know, of servant or servants.
That we call deacon today.
Exactly. It is literally the root of deacon, and it's sometimes translated as deacon in the New Testament, other times translated as servant. And bizarrely, it's used to describe Phoebe, it's used to describe Jesus, it's used to describe the 12 apostles, it's used to describe St. Paul, it's used to describe all sorts of people who weren't deacons, or weren't only deacons in the case of the ordained, and then it's not used in Acts 6 to describe the first seven deacons. And so...
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, you just can't make the word-based argument. It's not a very strong argument. And the reason is really simple. By the time the New Testament documents are being written, the first documents are probably St. Paul's letters. Well, we know they're St. Paul's letters to churches,
right?
Meaning the church predates the New Testament. So you don't have some New Testament instruction guide on how to build the church from scratch,
right?
Because they weren't building churches from scratch. The churches already existed. And so it's only...
And by the time we have the first New Testament document, we'll call, let's say, First mm-hmm. Thessalonians, The church has existed for 20 years.
Right.
For 20 years. That's the church has gone through one generation before you have the first canonical document in the New Testament. So, I mean, 20 years is a long time to have a leadership structure in place.
Yeah. And so in 1 Timothy 3 talks about the bishop singular and then talks about deacons, and it doesn't mention elders. But then in 1 Timothy 5, elders are mentioned. So people are left saying, okay, well, does he think elders is just another term for the bishop or for deacons, or is he describing three offices? And I think someone going just off the text alone wouldn't be able to conclusively arrive at a conclusion. And I think, case in point, Protestantism has massively different ecclesiologies.
Right.
That the structure of a Protestant church varies more widely from denomination to denomination than almost any bit of theology or any other
belief.
Some
Protestants have bishops. Other Protestants just have a single pastor.
Exactly.
Some are more congregationalist.
Right. You'll have congregational, presbyteral, and episcopal governance, and a ton of variations on that theme. John Calvin argued there was a fourfold structure in the church, and no one takes his view. And then St. Paul mentions all of these ministries and offices without specifying which ones are which. You just, from the text alone, from the biblical text alone, you're not able to reconstruct in the same way that if you were to just take like the speeches of George Washington to try to figure out what the structure of the United States looks like, you probably couldn't do it.
Right.
Because it's, you know, he might address like the governors or something. But, oh, are there a lot of governors per state? Or is he addressing all of the governors in the country? You know, those kinds of things. Because it was never meant to be used for that. Like that's a misuse of the New Testament.
Both the New Testament, and we have things like the letters of St. Ignatius of Antioch. And then we go, well, though, when we go even further, unfortunately, we don't have a lot to draw from, because at least in the early... Because I think a lot of these critics will say, I'm willing to give you by the time of Pope Victor I, you have the papacy.
Right.
A lot of them are willing to grant, yes, we have a bishop of Rome who has authority over other bishops or other churches. And that would place us around the end of the second century.
Right.
But what we look at, like, really, our biggest witnesses are going to be the letter of Clement, who we would traditionally recognize to be the third successor of St. Peter, the fourth pope. And then the writings of St. Ignatius of Antioch, because we've got other, they're really more minor Greek apologists like Athenagoras or Tatian the Syrian. They're not talking about church governance.
Well, I think the other source we have is later in the second century, but looking backwards,
would
be the Roman lists compiled by Hegesippus in 160 and Irenaeus in 180, that they are tracing every bishop from the time of the apostles, every bishop of Rome. From the time of the apostles down to their day with Eleutherius, who's the 13th successor.
And people try to write that off like, oh, well, St. Irenaeus, you know, he's writing 150 years after the time of Jesus. But in your book, which you all should pick up, by the way, the early church was a Catholic church. I need my little royalty after that.
Exactly.
you make a good connection that that's not that far. You use an example of Alice von Hildebrand, who just recently passed away.
The example was applicable when the book came out and then
and
for
then
about 4
away.
Weeks after.
Yeah.
And I point out that the gap in time between the death of the apostles Peter and Paul and the time of the writing of Against Heresies in 180 is like 114 years. And 114 years ago, the now late Alice von Hildebrand, who is still alive, her husband was in college, and she has a book describing what it was like for Diedrich von Hildebrand at university. She didn't, of course, know him then, but she married him and was still alive when the book came out. So 114 years, not that long. The other example is just take the actual second century. Like, we know the Apostle John dies in about 100. He has two students we know of, Ignatius of Antioch, which we've already mentioned, and then Polycarp of Smyrna. Polycarp is born in 69 AD. He dies at the age of 86 in 155 AD. We know a lot of details of his martyrdom because accounts of his martyrdom are written down before 12 months is up.
Right.
I mean, in honor of the 1 year anniversary of his death, an account of his martyrdom is published. And he is the mentor of Irenaeus. So Irenaeus learned Christianity from a student of the apostle. Like, it's this is also, like, by the way, Irenaeus is the first person to tell us Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four gospels.
Right.
So Protestants who say we can't trust Irenaeus, he's a liar, he's making up details about the Church of Rome, he's either untrustworthy because he's like a total dupe and somehow was tricked into believing a 30-year-old institution was 115 years old, or he's a liar by trying to somehow convince the Romans that they've always had.
And I think this comes up, and for me, it really shows to a burden of proof that I think that we should push back on. That I would say the burden of proof is not on us proving that there was a first century bishop of Rome, but why should I believe the critics? I think they make a lot of dubious, most of their arguments are very dubious arguments from silence. Mm-hmm. And arguments from silence are dangerous. I'm actually working on this in my current book, comparing the arguments between Protestants and atheists, that atheists do the same thing, or liberal Protestants. They'll say, well, if Jesus was really born of a virgin, why didn't Paul say so?
Right.
Why didn't Mark say so? Mythicists will say, well, if Jesus really did was a man who taught and not just a myth, why doesn't Paul quote Jesus's teaching about taxes in Roman 13 when he does say pay your taxes? Like, I don't know, but that doesn't take away from the evidence I do have for these things.
And so, we can even give at least a tentative response to that.
We can.
Which is that they're writing on scrolls and they're writing with limitation. Now, anyone old enough listening to this who remembers T9 phones when you had to carefully like push 7 3 times in order to get a T or whatever, you know your text messages were a lot shorter than they are now because it's a lot easier to write. So right now, you can write a 70,000 word book because it's easy to type and correct mistakes when they come up and go back and edit and edit in chunks. When you're writing by hand on a scroll, word economy is enormous. So the physical writings of the first and second century are much shorter than later books. Mm-hmm. And it's not shocking why they are. And before the printing press, writings are shorter. So making an argument from silence that a guy who writes for 3 pages doesn't include every Christian teaching, it's a miserably weak argument.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the arguments of silence that are made. So one would be that there is no bishop at Rome because when St. Ignatius of Antioch writes to the Church of Rome, his letter to the Romans, he doesn't mention that there is a bishop at Rome. He doesn't discuss anything like that. And I want to bring it up so we don't forget. It was a great analogy we were discussing before this episode, was that he certainly does. It's certainly there is a single bishop of churches in his time because he refers to himself in the letter to the church at Rome. He refers to himself as a bishop, and in the other letters to the other churches in Asia Minor, which is now modern day Turkey, he addresses that it is presumed there is a single bishop in those churches. So why wouldn't we just so the analogy you gave, I'll let you explain it, would be about, let's say someone like Dr. James Dobson was writing letters to 7 Christian churches on marriage. So take us away.
Okay. So just to spell out a little more of the argument from silence you're talking about.
Yes.
Father Raymond Brown is one of the most famous to offer this. He says, to explain Ignatius's insistence on and defense of the threefold order, one must posit that the single bishop model appeared in Antioch in Asia Minor, circa 100. So because bishops are mentioned in Ignatius's other letters, therefore they must be new.
Yeah, because he's insisting that you follow the bishop. This must be a new thing he has to drill into people.
But then later in the same book, he argues that the signal failure of Ignatius to mention the single bishop in his letter to the Romans, he goes on to say, makes it likely that the single bishop structure did not come to Rome till circa 140 to 150. So if he mentions it or if he doesn't mention it, either way, that proves Father Brown's case that the papacy didn't exist. And that's a terrible argument from silence. It's a heads I win, tails you lose argument.
Right, because here's the thing. What we could ask then, Father Brown, is, Father Brown, what would Ignatius have to say?
Or not say.
Or not say
right.
for you to believe that this institution has been around for a long time? Because for me, I mean, he might say, well, if he said that we've received this from the apostles, well, why wouldn't you could just say he's like Irenaeus and he's been duped, you know?
Right.
You could still come up with an excuse, even if you had something like that. So you're right. So if he does say, follow the bishop, he's so insistent, it must be new. And he doesn't tell the people at Rome to follow their bishop. Oh, that means there was no bishop. We can't have the third alternative. Well, it's just presumed every church has a bishop.
Exactly. I mean, the one thing it proves is that bishops already exist in at least 6 of the 7 churches.
Yeah.
You know, because he's not telling them you should really put a bishop in place. He's greeting their bishops by name.
So let's imagine James Dobson writes his letters on marriage.
So imagine he's got 6 letters, and to the first 6 families, he writes, obey your mom and dad. And in the 7th, and he, you know, he mentions in the letters, you don't have a family without a mother and father, or, you know, whatever. And then the 7th one, he just praises the family as a model family and maybe says something about the parents, but doesn't go into any detail about the mother and father.
Or let's
explicitly
say this 7th letter he's writing to the Joneses. And he says, this is a family that I take lessons from. Yes. I don't give this family lessons. So let's say he's writing to seven families about what it means to have a Christian marriage. Six of them, obey your mom and dad. Obey, there needs to be a mother and father. To the Joneses, hey, the Joneses, that is the family. I take lessons from them, people. But he never says that the Joneses have a mother and father.
Yeah, he refers to this church, Ignatius, when he's speaking to the Romans, refers to them as the church that presides. And he describes them as presiding in charity. He speaks to them as one that he looks up to rather than as one he feels feels like he can give unsolicited advice to.
Right.
And so it's not shocking that he's not going to give unsolicited advice. In the same way that if you're saying, I really, you know, I'm writing to you this great model family, that's not the time that you're probably going to launch into obey your mother and father and do this, do that.
And it would be ridiculous to say in that example, oh, he wrote to the Joneses. They're the model family. If someone said, if you notice in Dr. Dobson's letter, he only uses the terms family and parents. Not once in the letter to the Joneses does he say mother or father.
Therefore, it was a gay marriage. Yeah.
Therefore, the Joneses were a same-sex couple.
Right.
Because otherwise, if they were this model family, you would say that makes no sense. He doesn't have to say it because it's presumed in the that they are the paradigmatic example, the model. Just like when Ignatius writes to the church at Rome, if there are bishops in other churches, and this is the best church, the one that leads the others, it's going to be the same as the others, and there's going to be a bishop there.
And Ignatius mentions, as you kind of alluded to, he mentions being the bishop in the singular sense twice in his letter. So he assumes they know that there's one bishop per city. And again, he holds them up as the model. But more than that, if you want to understand, like, why does the letter to the Romans read differently, there are really, really obvious reasons.
Yes.
In the case of all the other letters, he's writing to churches that he knew personally from his travels through Asia Minor en route to his martyrdom.
Yeah, you can look on a map, all of them, to the Traians, the Smyrnians, the Magnesians, the Ephesians. Mm-hmm. When you look at them on a map, you can put little pinpoint dots in, and it's all within like a day's journey.
Yeah.
It's all within like a day's journey of Antioch, and he's the big heavy hitter because he's the bishop of Antioch.
And these are probably people who had personally ministered to him as he's a prisoner, because the Romans didn't feed prisoners. They would have other people come and take care of prisoners.
For background for everyone, the letters of St. Ignatius of Antioch, they were written while he was being escorted to Rome for his martyrdom. And so he is writing letters during this time. And the Romans, like you say, they're not going to take care of you. Oh, you have visitors? They can give you bread.
Right.
And you can give them letters at that time.
And so that's why he's in a position where he can give them advice, because he knows them. He knows them intimately. In the same way that if you're writing letters to friends and family, you might give them advice on their current situation that you wouldn't give unsolicited to people you don't know. To the Romans, he doesn't know them. The reason he's writing to them is not to give them pastoral counsel. It's explicitly to ask them not to interfere in his martyrdom and not to risk their own life trying to save him from martyrdom.
And I would say, for me, another reason, because people will say, oh, well, why doesn't he mention the Bishop of Rome by name? The fact that he doesn't mention the Bishop of Rome by name means there was no Bishop of Rome. Oh, well, that's an interesting argument. But Ignatius doesn't mention any Christian by name in the Church of Rome. Right. Logically, there must have been no Christians in Rome.
He doesn't mention deacons. He doesn't mention presbyters. We might as well argue those didn't exist either. Like, the argument from silence is very selectively applied.
It makes
here.
Sense that he's not going to mention the names of these people. In the letter to the Romans, Ignatius only mentions Crocus, someone who is traveling with him, who is there in Asia Minor. If this letter is intercepted, he's not going to give the Romans the names of the prominent Christians in the city of Rome. So I think that, I think these arguments from silence, we're on the wrong burden of proof here. I want to see the other side make that demonstration. And I think the arguments are pretty weak. So why don't you tie it together?
Well, I'd like to maybe lay out the argument in the opposite direction on the argument for silence, if I may.
Yes.
Because Father McGuckian has a piece from 2005 in New Blackfriars where he points out that the notion of a church choosing its church order is unheard of in Christian tradition until the 16th century.
So this is our argument from silence.
Just like chooses to change its structure is totally unheard of. And if you think about it, it would be insanely disruptive, and you would find a lot of evidence of that disruption. If you went into a Baptist church and said, from now on, I'm the sole leader of this church, people are going to have something to say about that.
Right.
Or, you know, you just say, well, this was, you know, this nice Roman democracy, I'm going to replace it with a single Caesar. People are going to have something to say, pro or con, or just observing the change. There's zero evidence of the change. That's a really remarkable lack of evidence, that they're literally arguing from no evidence that a massive revolution happened. It's like, oh, we don't have any evidence of this 5-year period in French history. They must have gotten rid of the government and installed a dictatorship. Like, that'd be an insane conclusion to go to from the silence.
But that's what we're arguing for, that these critics, including some Catholic scholars, will argue, well, what happened in the early church was that it was originally a council of elders. Some will say a council of elders. Some will just say it was just straight, the more Protestants that are not as scholarly. It was just democratized household churches. Others will say, well, there were councils of elders and priests, but not single bishops. That arose much later. Well, then there had to be a change. Everyone's like, go to church. Who's this bishop? We have a bishop? What's going on now? This like, oh, well, eventually there would be this massive disruption. You would think there would be people who would be for and against this, and it would be a source of controversy. But we can say, well, no, it doesn't. There is no evidence of that controversy. And we could take the critics' own argument from silence to say, that shows there was no controversy because there was a single leadership structure prevailing the church during this time period.
Leon Morris in the Evangelical Dictionary of Theology makes just this argument. Wow. He says, nowhere is there evidence of a violent struggle, as would be natural if a divinely ordained Congregationalism or Presbyterianism were overthrown. Because that's an important point. Like, if the apostles set this structure up and you, just some random guy, came along and scrapped it, wouldn't one or two faithful Christians, not just the normal politics of the thing of like, I was leading and you usurped my power, but like you usurped Jesus.
Look at the strife that took place at the end of the second century over the Quarto Deciman controversy.
Yes.
That is the controversy about when to celebrate Passover. Do we use the Jewish lunar calendar, or do we celebrate it according to the liturgical calendar? And so it always falls on a Sunday, you know? And that was a huge deal when Pope Victor tried to make it uniform and people trying to celebrate it, the dispute and disagreement between the two camps. And that's just over a liturgical, the dating of a liturgical feast, not
and one
how
that there
we
had
run the
clearly
church.
Been a diversity in that they knew about. The second century Christians knew that the churches established by Philip and John went by the Jewish calendar. The other 10 apostles' churches went by the Roman calendar.
People knew about this dispute for a long time. And
exactly.
Yet we're supposed to believe there would have been this heavily disputed change from congregational worship or from a council of priests to a bishop. And yet there's no record of anyone talking about this change ever.
And if they did feel free to change structures, it's really remarkable that the hundreds of churches for which we have records of by the early 3rd century, by the early 200s, all of them have the exact same structure.
Right.
Isn't that weird? Like, you know, if every country has the ability to choose its own system of governance, they don't all have the same one. That's kind of weird. That's more or less what you would expect. But imagine if they all had identical structures. That would make you think maybe they don't feel free to pick and choose
because
their structure.
They're receiving a leadership structure, a hierarchy, sacred order in Greek hierarchy, that is part of the deposit of faith itself that was given by the apostles.
And Pope Clement, tying this back to the start of the conversation, 96, describes this as something that they receive from the apostles. In other words, he explicitly disclaims the idea this is something they invent or create or adapt, but something they receive. It's the same kind of way that Irenaeus and Hegesippus talk about it later. The apostles establish this and it comes down.
Right.
Not, we decided, you know, we had a committee meeting, we decided this would be the best structure for our church. So these scholars are suggesting something that has no historical precedent prior to the Reformation and is totally detached from lived experience and reality. Like, it's an otherworldly kind of world they're describing in which people just say, oh, okay, well, if you want to scrap the biblical church for a new one, we won't complain or write about it or notice it. We'll just go on our merry way. It's unreal. It's very hard when you actually try to prove the emergent case to find any scrap of historical evidence that couldn't be better explained in the Catholic view.
Man, this is fun. It's so fun to come back
and just hang out.
We're going to have to bat this around a little bit more. Definitely have you back on the show soon. But until we do that, I'm going to recommend there's so much more we could have talked about and a lot more of other related subjects. Your book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Where can people get a copy
of that? It's on sale right now. You can do bulk sales even for as cheap as like $3 a book from shop.catholic.com, Catholic Answers Shop. You can also get it from your local Catholic bookstore or Amazon or wherever you buy Catholic books.
I like it. Mr. Joe Heschmeyer, thank you so much for being here today. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. Check out Joe's book. Also, I have a new course on the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, schoolofapologetics.com, a course on arguing about abortion. It'll equip you to be pro-life. Definitely something you want to check out. But thank you guys so much. I hope you all have a very blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.